This is Chief for Yourself. Now, here's Gio.
Hi, and welcome to Chief for Yourself. Great to have you with us, wherever you are in the world at this moment. Today's society gets pretty much of its forward motion on things like performance, competition, and perfection, which leads to a big increase in stress. Stress causes damage that's often underestimated, and it's a social phenomenon. It's being examined and evaluated all the time. Our guest today says empathy helps us produce our own natural stress-reducing chemicals. Dr. Arthur Sierra McCauley has been on the faculty of Harvard Medical School. He's a licensed clinical psychologist and the chief medical officer of the mental health platform SoundMinds.org. He's authored several books, including The Stress Solution, Using Empathy and Cognitive Behavioral Therapy to Reduce Anxiety and Develop Resilience. And if we ever needed a solution to a pressing problem, this would be it. And Arthur, The Stress Solution is a most inviting title, but the layperson might be wondering, what is cognitive behavioral therapy? Take us through a definition of CBT.
Sure. John, cognitive behavioral therapy basically focuses on correcting distorted thinking. So it's more presently focused. It doesn't focus on the past. I use empathy to do that part of this formula. But cognitive behavioral therapy basically focuses how we perceive in distorted ways based on old conditioning from early in our lives. So when we generalize or we use black and white thinking or we catastrophize or we magnify, whenever we're misperceiving, when we're not perceiving the truth, we're producing the stress hormone cortisol. And when we produce the stress hormone cortisol, it has many, many negative complications. You know, it causes inflammation, it causes weight gain, it causes the loss of muscle tissue, it causes increase in fat cells, it causes insomnia, it causes anxiety, and it can cause depression. And most importantly, and which is most common, is it causes a loss of memory. It actually kills memory cells in the memory center of the brain. So it kills neurons in the memory center of the brain. So if we're misperceiving on a consistent level, and that's where cognitive distortions really come into play, we're often stressed on a daily basis. And, you know, Americans today indicate that in 2015, 75% of Americans say that they experience stress on a physical or emotional level every day. And 50% of Americans say that they wake up every night due to stress. And 75% of visits to primary care physicians were due to stress in 2015. So we really are experiencing a stress epidemic, and cognitive behavioral therapy focuses on helping us being able to perceive the truth rather than perceiving from old conditioning that can continue to produce ongoing tension.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure most people would agree that there certainly is a big jump in stress in their lives and just about everything they look at and see. Why such a big jump in stress?
Well, you know, Americans have fewer friends today. We used in the 15 years ago, Americans said they had 5 to 6 friends. Today, they say they have 2 or 3. So stress levels have increased as we have fewer friendships. We have fewer trust. The trust factor is percentages are down as well, and people are experiencing less empathy toward other people as well. In addition, there's an increase in prejudice in our society. So all of those factors put together, as well as our tremendous focus on appearance and status, you know, that's what I call performance addiction. I think we've really sacrificed teaching our children good character and integrity. We've replaced that with a tremendous emphasis on appearance and status and performance addiction. It's a belief that develops very early in life that if you achieve on high levels and you perfect your appearance, that is the way to win love and respect in life. And of course, I see in my practice, and I'm sure you've seen in your life, that that's really mythical. What really produces strong friendships and a sense of peace and success in life is being able to communicate with empathy. You know, the ability to connect with other people and see them and understand them beyond the surface, to see into the heart and souls of other people. So the reduction in trust with each other, the reduction in friendship, the reduction in empathy, and the increase in prejudice have all contributed to an increase in stress.
If I could single out friendship for just a moment, I read something recently about acquaintances giving us the same beneficial effects as friends. Do you see it that way?
No, I wouldn't see it that way, because I think especially with social media, John, there are a number of people that talk about their friends, and then when you ask them, do they do anything with them? Do they go out with them? They have lunch with them? They exercise with them? Play tennis? They say, well, I've never seen this friend. They're Facebook friends. And they really are acquaintances. They're not friends. I mean, we call them friends on social media, but in order to really have friendships and to give and receive empathy, which is what really allows us to preserve our health, because it produces the very miraculous hormone oxytocin. And I can say more about that at some point in our talk. But I don't think acquaintances create the depth of friendship that we need to really produce those calming neurochemicals in our system.
Hmm. There's a great quote in the advanced publicity to the book. We work too much, sleep too little, and love with half a heart. Given that we understand work and sleep levels, what does it mean to love with half a heart?
Well, I think we have trouble being present. You know, there's a section in the book on empathic listening, which I call holy listening. It's listening another person's soul into a position of discovery and disclosure, really, again, seeing beyond the surface and seeing into the heart and soul of another person. Empathy is basically everyday mind reading. It's being able to understand a person on a deeper level. And that's what creates a very deep connection. And if we're sleep deprived, if we're not eating well, if we're overweight, if we're working 70, 80 hours a week, we're not present. So we don't really listen to the other person. We don't really make a deeper connection. And that's what loving with half a heart is.
Mm. Well, you've said a number of times that we don't see ourselves accurately, our perception being muddied largely through conditioning. Talk about what the conditioning is and where it comes from. I'm sensing early on maybe family and family surroundings.
Yes, I mean, we need to understand our past so that our theories and old patterns don't interfere with understanding and perceiving. So if you're unaware of your own biases from the past, your ability to perceive accurately is going to be compromised. For instance, if you have a fear of anger because your father had a short temper, you may be overly sensitive to people you encounter who are passionate but not angry. So these sensitivities develop very early in life, and then we start to misperceive. There's a chapter in the book on prejudice, which I was delighted that my publisher allowed me to write, because, you know, when you think of it, these are forms of prejudices. And if you grew up with prejudice in your own family, like toward Italians or Irish or African Americans or Muslims or whoever they are, then you're going to feel stress when you're around these people. And you don't realize that these are biases and ways of thinking that really aren't based on truth or objectivity. They're based on what you heard and what you encoded in your mind very early in life.
I read medical articles and blogs that suggest that to combat stress, we talk about our problems with people we trust. By expressing your feelings, your stress will be reduced. When does the problem of the stress reach a point when a person really should seek you out and get professional help?
Well, I think, you know, this book is a workbook, John, and it teaches people how to slow down and use empathy to find out where your old conditioning was so that you can perceive accurately. There are exercises at the end of each chapter. There's really a request to keep a journal as you're going through the book and to not read it quickly, but to do the exercises. And then at the end of each chapter, I have a take action part, which I ask people basically to take an action, because I believe change is an active process. You can't just think about it or read about it. You have to put it into action. So if you read this book and you don't find yourself learning as you're sharing with other people enough to reduce your anxiety, then it is important to consult someone like myself, a clinical psychologist or other mental health professional.
Mm. And there are lots of questions in the book to determine if you're a performance addict. Talk about some of those questions.
Well, the performance addict really is really trying to, the questions are focusing on what your feelings about your appearance are, what your feelings are about status, and what you came to believe in life would bring you love and respect, which is what all human beings want. And as I said earlier, performance addiction is the belief that perfecting appearance and achieving status will secure love and respect. And, you know, my first recognition of performance addiction came about largely as a result of working with a group of individuals who embodied so many of the qualities that are highly regarded in professional and public life, but their resumes were very impressive, but I noticed despite their capabilities, they seemed to have little regard for their personal achievements or their physical appearance. They all seem to be what I call scoreboard watchers. And that's those are other questions in the questionnaire. Are you always comparing and contrasting yourself to others? Are you always comparing and contrasting your mate to others? Are you always comparing and contrasting your children to others, and your house to others, and your 401k to others, and so forth and so on? It's this constant comparing every day, taking inventory of how well or how terribly you're performing, how attractive or how dreadful you look in the mirror, that really contributes to a high level of stress. And so when people take that quiz, the performance addiction quiz, most people in this country test in the moderate range, or some test in the severe range. But there are other questionnaires, as you know, in the back of the book. There's a stress questionnaire. Mm-hmm. There's an empathy questionnaire as well, to see where you fall in those regards.
Our guest on this Chief for Yourself is Dr. Arthur Sierra McCauley, author of The Stress Solution, Using Empathy and Cognitive Behavioral Therapy to Reduce Anxiety and Develop Resilience. Now, you mentioned some recommendations, getting good sleep and diet. How do you feel about a meditation practice?
Oh, I think meditation is extremely helpful. You know, meditation slows our processes down, and it really reduces tension significantly, as does yoga and other certain practices, as does aerobic exercise. One of the things that I think we underestimate is that we can produce this kind of brain chemistry on our own when we know how to encounter other people empathically. When we give and receive empathy, we produce oxytocin, which is that amazing hormone that, you know, reduces anxiety and cortisol levels, the stress hormones. It's been proven to help us live longer, to aid in recovery from illness. It promotes a sense of calm and well-being. It increases empathy and generosity, whereas cortisol, the stress hormone, we know from certain studies, reduces empathy. And it reduces craving for addictive substances. It creates a bonding and an increase in trust of others, and it decreases fear. So it gives us a sense of security with other people, which again allows us to feel safe, vulnerable, and able to open up and form deeper relationships, deeper friendships, and have deeper relationships with those that are closest to us.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we're also talking about reducing inflammation, I guess, which is a big killer, I mean, as far as the major diseases, no?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we've learned so much over the last 10 years about inflammation and the negative effects of it, but oxytocin, which is produced when we give and receive empathy, reduces inflammation. Stress, which produces cortisol, increases inflammation. And one of the things that stress does when it produces cortisol also that I think is underestimated is it causes weight gain, because it throws the excess cortisol in the system, throws off the blood sugar levels, and it creates a desire for simple sugars and increases the size of fat cells. And in most weight loss programs, that isn't even discussed, that isn't even talked about. So when you're very stressed, your brain is desiring the simple sugars, because simple sugars do calm you temporarily. It doesn't last very long, but it does calm you temporarily.
And that weight gain, as I understand it, a lot of that is a visceral fat. It's in that midsection, what we usually call the gut.
Yes, yes. I mean, that's the most destructive place to have weight gain, because mm-hmm. it's so close to our major organs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you walk around today, you see so many people who are overweight. And, I mean, we have the highest rates of childhood obesity in the civilized world now. We have the highest rates of obesity in adults in the civilized world now. And so it's a major concern, and stress is one of the critical factors in weight gain and maintaining excessive weight, because it throws off that blood sugar level in our bodies, and people don't even realize that's what's happening. And when it's happening, you're desiring simple sugars to calm yourself down, because when you take in simple sugars, it does produce a calming effect, but only temporarily, and then, of course, it depletes you very quickly, and then you need more sugar, and you're in this cycle of sugar highs up and down all day long.
Hmm. Now, a listener might be confusing at this point. Empathy from sympathy. Talk about the differences in those two.
Yeah, empathy is the capacity to understand and respond to the unique experience of another. It's essentially everyday mind reading. You know, empathy is part of our genetic endowment. It's not an emotion or a feeling, but it's a capacity that's innately present. We're born with it. We're born with the capacity, but if it's not developed, it'll atrophy like an unused muscle. Let me give you an example, John, of the difference between empathy and sympathy. I had a client the other day who said to me that, you know, her dad had passed away last year, and she was very, very close to her father, and she was devastated and still is by the loss of her dad. She moved into a neighborhood in Massachusetts, and she heard that one of her neighbors, who she did not know very well, her father also passed away a few days ago. So she made a flower arrangement. She put together some food, and she brought it over to her neighbor, and she rang the doorbell, and the neighbor answered the doorbell, and she said, "Oh, my God, I'm so sorry. I heard that you lost your dad. I lost my dad last year. You must be devastated. I was so devastated." And the neighbor looked at her and said, "Thank you very much for your generosity, but my father left us when we were 2 years old, never came back. I wouldn't know my father if he was walking down the street, so I'm sorry that you're devastated by the loss of your father, but I never knew my father, so I'm not devastated." You see, sympathy rushes in to console without having the facts. Sympathy is based on identification, meaning that was my experience, so it must be your experience. Empathy, on the other hand, slows down the process to wait to find out the facts before you respond. So this was a sympathetic response, not an empathic response. You know, empathy is very truth-oriented, and that's why it helps us perceive accurately. So if we see someone that doesn't look like us, or someone of a different color or a different race, or we find out if they're a different religion, we don't automatically start assuming we know who they are. We wait to find out the facts of who they are. Mm-hmm. And basically, sympathy is very quick and impulsive and rushes in, with good intentions often. But people don't often feel listened to when you're rushing in with sympathy, because you can easily misconstrue what they're experiencing, as this woman did in the experience she told me about last week. Mm-hmm.
If we can go back to prejudice, and I am also glad you mentioned this in the book, the effects of prejudice. And I'm asking now on a kind of a macro level, rather than talking to one person, if you were to say to society in general one thing to sort of curb, I guess, prejudice, or to somehow address prejudice, what would you say to people in general to do something about the terrible spate of prejudice that we're seeing?
Well, this is extremely concerning to me, John, and I think what we need to realize is whenever we encounter someone who we have an inherent prejudice against, whether conscious or unconscious, we begin to experience a degree of stress. When we're stressed, we release the stress hormone cortisol, which limits our capacity for empathy while also causing repetitive negative thinking. So if you're prejudiced against several types of people, it's likely that your cortisol levels would be consistently high, in addition to causing negative thinking and all the other negative effects that we talked about a few minutes ago of cortisol release. So in order to not be prejudiced, we have to keep unlearning some of the distorted views that were created early in our lives by the people that we were exposed to or what we heard. So we have to ask ourselves, do we really know these people? Because what empathy teaches us is that when we really get beyond the surface, we're all more alike than not alike. We all are. Human beings have a tremendous amount in common. And when we use empathy, we can form relationships with all kinds of people who don't initially seem like us, but underneath they want to be loved and respected just like we do. So, you know, people with the highest degree of empathy are most successful, interestingly, in the professional world as well as in their personal lives, because they can remake relationships with anybody. And we live in an international climate now. You know, so many of my clients go to India, they go to China, they go throughout Europe to sell their goods and vice versa. And we have to make relationships with people that come from different cultures. And when we just have an inherent prejudice against them, we're assuming again. We're assuming by misperception, by having cognitive distortions about them, that we know what they're about. Don't assume you know what a person is about until you learn more about them. Hmm. You know, when you learn more about even the major religions, they have so much in common if you really read about them and read the original text. But people just, you know, they get a soundbite on TV and they think that they know what this person or that person is about. And again, our prejudice rates have increased. We need to decrease them. We need to find the common ground with other people, and this is critically important with children. You know, our daughter is a kindergarten teacher, and she will tell you in her class of, I think, 22 children this year, 11 of them were from other countries. And she'll tell you that when they're out in the playground, they all get along. They're all hugging each other. The boys have just as much empathy as the girls. They don't make fun of each other. They don't notice color. They don't pay attention to last names. But she will tell you, by the time they're in the fourth and fifth grade, you see a significant difference. Why? Because what they're exposed to. You know, they're bringing home this person, or they want to go have a play date with that family, and the parents make a comment, or, oh, we don't want you playing with this one or that one. You know, in the chapter on prejudice, I have 10 or 12 comments by, interestingly, college-educated people that were made. I don't want my child playing with this group or that group. And, of course, the kids hear this, and now their world is becoming smaller, and their world is becoming more stressful. Because now they can't have a relationship with someone of a different religion, or they can't have a relationship with someone of a different race. And we're creating stress in our children. We're teaching them incorrectly that they can't connect with certain people that they already connected with.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens as they grow up? They basically have to unlearn what they learned early on and get back to that basic goodness. You know, there's a chapter in the book, as you know, on goodness, mm-hmm. which and how giving produces oxytocin as well.
Right.
You know, people who are giving are 13 times more healthy than people who are just takers. And we know about, you know, the helper's high. It produces oxytocin also when we're helping people and we're oriented to helping people. So the prejudice issue is significant in our society, and every time we don't focus on what the truth is, we're passing that on to other people, whether they're our children, our coworkers, our friends, and we then become one of the people who are causing more pain and stress in our society and in our lives, rather than being people who are making a change, being a change agent. Empathy allows us to be a change agent because it connects people who on the outside don't look alike, but on the inside certainly are.
Very well said. That sounds like a good stopping point to me. I'll ask you, where will we find your website?
Well, my website is balanceyoursuccess.com. You can get the book through the website by just clicking on either Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or the independent booksellers. Also, I believe Amazon has the book on sale this week.
Oh, okay.
Online.
Well, that's timely. All right. And the book is The Stress Solution, Using Empathy and Cognitive Behavioral Therapy to Reduce Anxiety and Develop Resilience, from our guest, Dr. Arthur C.R. McCauley. Thanks, Arthur, for a book that I think gives a great understanding of what stress is and a lot of useful tools to do something about it. All the best to you, and please come back and talk with us again.
Well, I would love to, John. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And we'll have a link to Dr. Sierra McCauley's website. You'll see that at chiefforyourself.com on the start page. And if you haven't done so already, subscribe to Genulines. Get the blog posts when you're on the start page there, and that will get you all the show information that you need. I've included some stress-relieving tips in this week's blog post. I want to keep that helpful information coming to you, so keep an eye out for that in future posts and similar information. Like us on Facebook, too, and remember, we'll also be making the guest calls available there, so it's just one more way that you can access this information and hear from all of these great guests. We'll stop here for today. Thanks so much for choosing Chief for Yourself and for the likes and follows. Be well, and I'll talk to you soon.